Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
One day about 3 years ago, I found in The New Yorker, in that space they make for short lyric poems at the top of page 93 or 123, something by a poet I'd never heard of, Kay Ryan. The poem was called If She Only Had 1 Minute, and the first line read, "What would she put in it? If she only had 1 minute, what would she put in it?" When I read those lines, I felt, to borrow Emily Dickinson's famous phrase, as if the top of my head had been taken off. As soon as I could, I went to a bookstore and found Kay Ryan's third book, Elephant Rocks, which was published by Grove Press in 1996. I also learned that she had two previous books, Strangely Marked Metal and Flamingo Watching, that she had published in the Atlantic Monthly, the Paris Review, and the New Republic, and that her poetry had been included in the Best American Poetry of 1995. And I just happened to find out recently it's also been included in the Best American Poetry of 99. The fact that I'd never heard of Kay Ryan, despite my steady reading and her impressive publications, demonstrates the difficulty of keeping up with contemporary poetry. Most of us cope by reading selectively, focusing our attention on certain types of poetry while screening out others. We learn which poets we want to track, which presses, which journals, and thus we maintain our sanity and our conviction that somehow it all makes sense. Enter Kay Ryan, not a flamboyant confessional poet, not plain style, not ecstatic Whitman-esque, not a language poet, not a new formalist. Her work isn't anything like anyone's, nor does her name appear over and over on the roster of certain conferences or writing workshops so that she might be identified that way by frequent association with a particular group. As I try to place Kay Ryan's work in some kind of context, my mind keeps coming back to one name, Emily Dickinson. Like Dickinson's poems, Kay Ryan's are short, compressed, intense observations of nature, animal and human. They are meditations on moments of consciousness, on being. Although Ryan doesn't write in Dickinson's ballad measures, her poems are packed with witty and daring rhymes, off-rhymes, and wordplay. They are dense with alliteration and consonants, with the pleasure of words on the tongue. Unlike most contemporary poetry, Ryan's poems don't usually have people doing things in them. Nobody's having lunch, getting married, dying, or riding a bus. A Kay Ryan poem can describe a moment of utter mental and emotional devastation without ever saying what exactly happened or to whom. How can she do this? By doing what Dickinson did, by compressing essential truth so compactly and musically that we can't forget her words. And by the way, she came here tonight all the way from California. Please welcome Kay Ryan.
Thank you, Deborah, for a beautiful introduction. I think I'm going to become a Chicago poet. I think that'd do it. It's wonderful to be here. I'm very honored. My first trip to Chicago. Well, I knew I was going to be faced with opulence here, so I thought I'd start with a poem that's... the intention of this poem, this is a poem from Flamingo Watching. The intention of it is to think about extraordinary lengths. We only use that term extraordinary lengths when there's a lot of stress and emergency. You know, people go to extraordinary lengths. Well, it was my idea, with my kind of characteristic perversity, to liberate length from strain in this poem. You can decide how well I did it. Extraordinary lengths. The only justification for extraordinary lengths is extraordinary distances. See, I think that's really funny. That's very funny. Okay. The only justification for extraordinary lengths is extraordinary distances. Yet you don't find this in the majority of instances. No, rather, you see lengths swagged from balconies, ribbons of lengths rippling languidly, lengths spooling from enchanted cavities and grots. Actually, there is hardly a spot of sky or pool of water uncolored by some extraordinary length or other. Brothers fling bolts of gossamer off buildings with spectacular results. Birds negotiate an aerial spaghetti. Sure-footed goats find themselves unsteady. Poor people in brightly lacquered boats just help themselves to lengths that tangle up and float as pleasantly as kelp. Having read that, a poet friend of mine once said that she was wondering if it had political significance at the end. You know, she was feeling sorry for the poor people, you know, having to get their extraordinary lengths, leaning over from their boats. I told her it had absolutely no political significance whatsoever. So that's one little look into my mind, sort of the effort to, de-intensify life some way, make it less of an emergency. this poem's called This Life, and it's another painfully revealing poem that nobody would ever know was revealing unless I told. One of the techniques I thought might be useful in living life and avoiding trouble would be to make myself small. You know, it seems to me to make sense, but this is kind of what happened with that experiment. It's a pickle, this life. Even shut down to a trickle, it carries every kind of particle that causes strife on a grander scale. To be miniature is to be swallowed by a miniature whale. Zeno knew the law that we know. No matter how carefully diminished, a race can only be half finished with success. Then comes the endless halving of the rest, the ribbon stalled approach, the helpless, red-faced urgings of the coach. I was just telling Frederick Bush that we were sharing our enthusiasm for mysteries. And I especially love British ones for lines that you can find in them, such as this. This poem is called When Fishing Fails, and it has an epigraph from the British murder mystery Death is No Sportsman by Cyril Hare. This epigraph alone, I mean, it was just gravy, you know. I mean, you don't even have to read the poem. Your husband is very lucky, observed Smithers, to have ornithology to fall back upon when fishing fails. I was devastated. This is a celebration of the mild life. When fishing fails, when no bait avails, and nothing speaks in liquid hints of where the fishes went for weeks, and dimpled ponds and silver creeks go flat and tarnish, it's nice if you can finish up your sandwich, pack your thermos, and ford this small hiatus toward a second mild and absorbing purpose. And now a call to action. You know, we always say nothing forced works. Well, that's only half of it. Nothing works, right? So, well, here's my little contemplation of force. You may notice that my poems are full of bogus assertions, you know. Just bogus. Nothing forced works. Okay, I'm going to tell you, I think this next part's really funny, so I'll start again. Okay. I always hate if people don't laugh, you know? But if I warn them, then they can laugh. Nothing forced works. The Gordian knot just worsens if it's jerked at by a person. One of the main stations of the cross is patience. Another, of course, is impatience. There is such a thing as too much tolerance for unpleasant situations. A time when the gentle teasing out of threads ceases to be pleasing to a woman born for conquest. Instead, she must assault the knot or Alp or Everest with something sharp and take upon herself the moral warp of sudden progress. I see that spring has come to Chicago. Well, on my way in from O'Hare, I was astonished to see deer. You know that patch that has deer in it? All those trees on the right? You guys aren't nodding. There were a lot of deer. There really were. Lots of them. And there are like skyscrapers, and there's some wood. There are deer. Yeah, okay. There are deer. Well, that has nothing to do with the poem I'm reading. No, I think I'm going to have it. I was looking on the wrong page. Well, now I have to read this poem. This is called Deer. I live near a park called Deer Park in California, in Northern California. It also has nothing to do with that. It really has to do with, it's a kind of an incantation. I almost subtitled it an incantation, but that seemed a little ostentatious. Deer. To lure a single swivel ear, one tentative twig of a leg, or a nervous tail here, is to mark this place as the Emperor's Park, rife, I say rife with deer. For if one leaf against the littered floor be cleft with the true arc, all this lost ground and more becomes a park. Everywhere the nearest deer signals the nearest dark. A buck looks up. The touch of his rack against wet bark whispers a syllable singular to deer. The next one hears and shifts. The next head stops and lifts deeper and deeper into the park. And I did see deer. Okay, spring, now spring. That had nothing to do with spring. I just got off on the deer. This is called The Hinge of Spring, and I spent formative years. That's four, F-O-U-R, made of years. No, it isn't. I spent my adolescence on the Mojave Desert. So this is kind of a deserty spring poem. I like the exigencies of the desert. The Hinge of Spring. I guess it's a little ecological poem. You can decide. The jackrabbit is a mild herbivore grazing the desert floor, quietly abridging spring, eating the color off everything rampant high or lower. Rabbits are one of the things coyotes are for. One quick scream, a few quick thumps, and a whole little area shoots up blue and orange clumps. Not kind, but... Now, this is an odd poem. My original interest in this poem it has a grotesquely funny line in the middle. And I just liked it for that. And then I would read it just so I could say that line. And then people would go, oof, at the end. And so over the course of time, I've thought maybe it's beyond me. It's called Osprey, and at this time I was getting all my nature information from PBS. Now I just don't get any at all. But at that time I thought that ospreys were exclusive to Scotland. You know how those programs are. They actually lived right in my neighborhood, ospreys. And I have seen one do what is described here. Not the whole thing, but. So anyhow, the Scotland thing isn't quite right. But I mean, it's right. It's just not complete. Thank God this is a poem. All right. The great taloned osprey nests in Scotland. her nest's the biggest thing around, a spiked basket with hungry, ugly osprey offspring in it. For months she sits on it. He fishes, riding 2-pound salmon home like rockets. They get all the way there before they die, so muscular and brilliant, swimming through the sky. This poem's called Turtle, and I think it's terribly jammed up with images. It's very compacted, and it comes out of a time of feeling very frustrated. I become British suddenly. It happens, you know. So here it is. Who would be a turtle who could help it? A barely mobile hard roll, a four-oared helmet. She can ill afford the chances she must take in rowing toward the grasses that she eats. Her track is graceless, like dragging a packing case places, and almost any slope defeats her modest hopes. Even being practical, she's often stuck up to the axle on her way to something edible. With everything optimal, she skirts the ditch, which would convert her shell into a serving dish. She lives below luck level, never imagining some lottery will change her load of pottery to wings. Her only levity is patience, the sport of truly jacent things. Now I'm going to read a few poems from Elephant Rocks. This poem, entitled Doubt, features both a spurious science fact and a Coleridge reference. I should tell you about... Oh, you guys all know about the person from Porlock, right? Who interrupted Coleridge when he was writing Kubla Khan. Maybe, or maybe it was just the drugs wore off, right? I mean, nobody knows for sure. I asked a Coleridge expert. He became extremely exercised when I repeated that old thing about the drugs and not being able, not the inspiration leaving Coleridge, so who knows? I don't know. But there is a reference to the person from Porlock. Doubt. A chick has just so much time to chip its way out. Just so much egg energy to apply to the weakest spot or whatever spot it started at. It can't afford doubt. Who can? Doubt uses albumin at twice the rate of work. One backward look by any of us can cost what it cost Orpheus. Neither may you answer the stranger's knock. You know it is the person from Porlock who eats dreams for dinner, his napkin stained the most delicate colors. Now I'm going to read you a little bit tenderer poem. This probably comes from something about my desert youth also. It's called Mirage Oases, and they really were the only kind I saw. How many do you see in Chicago, for God's sake? I was feeling sorry for myself, but I have no reason to. Mirage Oases. First among places susceptible to trespass are mirage oases, whose graduated pools and shaded grasses, palms and speckled fishes, give before the lightest pressure and are wrecked. For they live only in the kingdom of suspended wishes, thrive only at our pleasure, checked. I'll bet some of you are familiar with that beautiful Richard Wilbur bestiary illustrated by Calder. Oh, it's a glory. It was republished not too many years ago. I think it was originally came out in the 60s, and then I think in the 80s or something that was a republication. I got a copy of it, and I'm very cheap, and I always, if I get an expensive book like that, I always like to get a poem out of it. And gee, I didn't even have to get any farther than the title on that, because I suddenly noticed that the word, which I'd always thought of as bestiary, since, you know, it has animals in it, is actually spelled bestiary, and I guess it's even pronounced bestiary. And hence this little contemplation. Bestiary. A bestiary catalogs bests. The mediocres, both higher and lower, are suppressed in favor of the singularly savage or clever, the spectacularly pinchered, the archest of the arch deceivers, who press their advantage without quarter, even after they've won, as of course they would. Best is not to be confused with good, a different creature altogether, and treated of in the goodiary, a text, alas, lost now for centuries. I thought that I wanted to be the sheriff of emptiness, you know, but I was just thinking right now, I might have to be the police of repetition. This little poem is called If the Moon Happened Once, and it's been kind of a lifelong contemplation of mine, just the glory of repetition, how it works, why it's so great. So this is thinking about if the moon happened once. If the moon happened once, it wouldn't matter much, would it? One evening's ticket punched with a round or a crescent. You could like it or not like it as you chose. It couldn't alter every time it rose. It couldn't do those things with scarves. It does. This is a little fantasy of being relieved from the heat of life, also attractive. It's called Crustacean Island, and it appeared in the New Yorker, and somebody in Indonesia sent me a postcard showing me an island that is like the thing I describe in here. It was pretty astonishing. He'd read the poem. He'd read it in Indonesia, and sent me this card. And the name of the island was something like Christmas Island. I don't know why. But listen to this. I mean, just think about it. There's an island like this. There could be an island paradise where crustaceans prevail. Click, click, go the lobsters with their china mitts and articulated tails. It would not be sad like whales with their immense and patient sieving and the sobering modesty of their general way of living. It would be an island blessed with only cold-blooded residents and no human angle. It would echo with 1,000 castanets and no flamencos. So there were just zillions on this postcard. There were just endless crabs. And there were no people on this island. It was just a crab island. Didn't make me want to go, really. There's some things we just like to imagine. This is a poem called Outsider Art. And I almost never write about anything that actually happens. Where you'd recognize it, as you so correctly noted. But I've got a friend who's a wonderful sculptor, and his work kind of looks like outsider art. And he loaned me a beautiful big book of outsider art, and I was surprised at my reaction to it. And this actually, well, I have to confess, nothing in here is, I made all these things up, but they're like, you know, they're like you would find in outsider art. None of them are specific to anything that was in that book. But I had a surprise reaction to the book. Most of it's too dreary or too cherry red. If it's a chair, It's covered with things the Savior said or should have said. Dense admonishments in nail polish, too small to be read. If it's a picture, the frame is either burnt matches glued together or a regular frame painted over to extend the picture. There never seems to be a surface equal to the needs of these people. Their purpose wraps around the backs of things and under arms. They gouge and hatch and glue on charms till likable materials, apple crates and canning funnels, lose their rural ease. We are not pleased the way we thought we would be pleased. You know how people say they are swept up whole. Well, this is a little poem about being swept up whole and the whole idea of being swept up whole. You aren't swept up whole, however it feels. You're atomized. The wind passes. You recongeal. It's a surprise. I'm going to read that again. It's short enough. Short enough so I can get away with that. You know, if it was Milton, you know. And I said, yeah. Let's take it from Satan again. Yeah. Swept up whole. You aren't swept up whole, however it feels. You're atomized. The wind passes. You recongeal. It's a surprise. You know it's happened to you. Oh, here's a little human relations poem. I can write human relations poems. This is called Any Morning, and it was actually inspired partly. I seem to be very very vulnerable to postcard images. Actually, I don't know if I got the postcard before or after I wrote the poem, come to think of it. But you know those pictures from Hawaii where you see the lava coming, and there's this sign that says, don't go past this point, lava, but it's almost buried. You know, it's on its side, and lava has covered it. Those ironic postcards. Well, I was sort of thinking of that kind of lava. Any morning can turn molten without warning. Every object can grow fluent. Suddenly the kitchen has a sulfur river through it. There is a burping from the closet, a release of caustic gases from the orange juice glasses. The large appliances are bonding in a way that isn't pleasant, on linoleum as friable as bacon. We never fathom how we caused it or why we never see it coming, like Hawaii. I was begged not to use that final rhyme. Why we in Hawaii, you know? My partner said, don't do that, Kay, don't do it. I said, I have to do it. Oh, I've got to hurry. I don't have to hurry that much. I'm a great reader of Ripley's Believe It or Not. I used it as a source of divination for years. It didn't work. It was very good when you don't have anything to do, you know, to just crack a book like that. And my nature is sort of to love not the eccentric, but to sort of see it's not going to have anything to do with the poem, but to see the amazing eccentricities of normality more in a way. You know, I mean, he's always seeing, Ripley, that is always seeing, you know, Lincoln's head in a potato and things like that, you know. I'm rambling. This poem was actually used at a wedding. I just want you to know that as you listen to it. I was astonished when the person told me that. This is called A Plain Ordinary Steel Needle Can Float on Pure Water. Have you ever tried it? It works. Who hasn't seen a plain ordinary steel needle float serene on water as if lying on a pillow?
The water cuddles up like jello. It's a treat to see water so rubbery, a needle so peaceful, the point encased in the tenderest dimple. It seems so simple when things or people have modified each other's qualities somewhat. We almost forget the oddity of that. Now, I have a new book coming out in September from Grove Press, and my partner again begged me not to name it Say Uncle. The title of the new book is Say Uncle. I'm going to read, oh, a couple from this. This poem is called Star Block, and it's to make you think of sunblock, you know. I thought of spelling it just, you know, B-L-O-K, so people would get it, but I don't know. I hope it'll be revealed in the poem. There is no such thing as star block. We do not think of locking out the light of other galaxies. It is light so rinsed of impurities, heat, for instance, that it excites no antibodies in us. Yet people are curiously soluble in starlight. Bathed in its absence of insistence, their substance loosens willingly, their bright designs dissolve. Not proximity, but distance burns us with love. Now I'm going to end on a little prayer. This is called Blandeur, and it's like grandeur, but with a bl. little prayer. If it please God, let less happen. Even out Earth's rondure, flatten Eiger, blanden the Grand Canyon. Make valleys slightly higher, widen fissures to arable land. Remand your terrible glaciers and silence their calving. Having or doubling all geographical features toward the mean. Unlean against our hearts. Withdraw your grandeur from these parts. Thank you.